This podcast is supported by Podcast Labs, Bournemouth's full-service podcast production and marketing agency.
Hello, welcome to The Tenth Degree. I'm your host, Anthony Story. What is an entrepreneur? What does it take to be an entrepreneur? It's not clear-cut, and it's not simple. I mean, for anyone who is trying to be one or has already been one in the past, you know it's not easy. There are so many things to ask. How important is your vision? How can you stack the odds in your favour? How can you make sure that the things you do, the choices you take, the objectives that you've got are actually going to turn out to deliver the results that you're desperate to try and achieve? It's such a good place for us to start. Andrew Walker has lived the dream and sold the company. He tells it as he sees it, openly, honestly, and really insightful. Hope you enjoy the episode. He's really entertaining. And if you enjoy it, please give us a review and come back for the next one. I'm here with Andrew Walker. Andrew is an entrepreneur, a mentor, a business advisor. You're a co-director of the Startup Grind and a lifelong football fan, which we'll definitely touch on a little bit later, I think. Andrew was co-founder of ClickTools, which provided him with a 14-year journey of... founding, growing, and ultimately selling a successful software business. For the sake of full disclosure, I need to say that Andrew and I have also worked together in delivering several startup accelerator programs, which means I have some first-hand experience witnessing some of the dubious practices Andrew employs in reducing someone with a badly thought-through business plan into something of a jabbering, quivering jelly.
And generally involves tears as well, I think.
I think the most dubious practice that you use is what some people might call telling the truth, and others might say is speaking your mind. So tell us about your approach when you start to talk.
It's a flattering introduction, isn't it?
When you start to talk to a company for the first time, what are you looking for when you first start talking and encountering somebody?
So I think it might be worth just giving a small amount of background, if that's okay, as to why I started to do this. So my first startup was a long, long time ago in 1989, and I suddenly became a sales and marketing director. I'd never done anything like it before as a product manager, and we did a management buyout and I became a sales and marketing director, and I had absolutely no idea what I was doing. So I tried to find help in Bournemouth. And at that time, I think there was Business Link and that was it. And I contacted Business Link and had a meeting with what turned out to be a butcher in on the hotel on Richmond Hill, the Norfolk, is it the Norfolk? Or the, Royal, the Norfolk, went there and met this butcher, who proceeded me to tell me about his two butcher shops. Well, I started to try to explain to him what I was doing and what software was, and he had absolutely no idea. And I had a couple of these conversations, and I just could not find anybody that could give me any help in a tech startup. And that conversation has sort of stood with me for ever since. And so when I was fortunate enough to leave ClickTools and be in a situation to help, my only goal was to try and help people in startups understand some of the complexities and the troubles and the highs and the lows that they would go through on that journey. And that was the only reason. The reducing to tears came later, I think. And I think some of that came from the way it was given to me when I was younger. But also I was very fortunate enough to be in an incubator in the USA and had some good American people helping me on my journey, and they were quite brutal. You know, it was like, this isn't going to work, you need to do it like that. And it was very much a traditional mentoring approach, you know, from the Greek, where you go and tell that person everything you know, which is the origins of the word. And I just literally thought, well, that's the way that you do it. And I have softened a lot, to be fair, but I was saying earlier, it's been a constant battle for 30 years how I calm my passion for subjects. But I still ultimately believe that we live in a world where being an entrepreneur and being in a startup is such a difficult thing to do, and everybody tends to look at it through very rose-tinted glasses, and they think it's the easiest thing in the world. They think they're going to become a multimillionaire overnight, and the reality is just so different from that. It's probably one of the hardest things. It's certainly one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life. Mm-hmm. And I think that people should. I just like to tell people the reality of the situation, rather than try and tell them that everything will be okay and they will be able to buy Necker Island off Richard Branson this time next year, because that's just not true.
I mean, that's a really good answer, but not actually to the question that I asked.
Well, I am training to be a politician. Okay. So that
No, but what I'm really interested in knowing is, when you first start talking to somebody, what are you trying to understand? Kind of, you've got, that initial 5-minute conversation, and you want to help them on that journey.
Yeah. So the first thing is, it is trying to understand where they're trying to get to. So I think it's very critical to, or very important to, understand what people's view of success is. Some people have a very different view of success, and there is no wrong view. So if you want to start your own business and work for yourself and earn a salary that keeps you in a comfortable way, then that's one thing, and that's a very valuable thing to do. If, on the other hand, you want to grow a business and start to employ people and go and raise venture capital and become a multi-million pound company, those are two very, very different things. So the first thing I'm trying to figure out is, what's their goal or their purpose for starting out on their own?
Mm-hmm.
If it's the former, then that's absolutely fine, but my set of skills are probably not suited to that. And I can help people do that. What I'm trying to figure out is what their goal is and how I can then best help them along that journey.
And with all the people who you've spoken to, how many people do you think have actually really thought about that, in terms of what is their plan? Are they thinking more in terms of, what's my product or what's my service, or are they thinking, what's my business plan?
Well, I think, unfortunately, in a majority of the cases, it's probably neither. I think this comes back to when I was doing well at not answering the question. It comes back to, this is what people think. A lot of people generally, they have an idea. Most people seem to have an idea right at the start and think this idea will turn them into millionaires. And it's as simple as that. They think, I've got this great idea. If I build it, why will everybody not buy it? And the reality is the complete opposite. Yeah. If you build it, they probably won't come. So it's trying to understand. From that point on, it's just a process of, in that first 5 minutes, it's asking, I try to understand where they are in their journey. So have they thought through who might buy their product or service, how many people they think might buy it, how many people they want to buy it, whether their product or service is something that might appeal to those people, and exactly where they are in their journey. Because I think where they are in their journey and where they're going to, for me, being a left brainer, being very logical, somebody called me the other day a linear thinker, as I pretend to think of myself as being focused. But, my immediate thought is, what are the steps that person is going to have to go through to get to where they're trying to be?
Okay.
It may be that there are two steps. If somebody says, well, all I need to do is get two customers paying me £200 a month and I'm fine, then that's a very different journey to somebody that says, well, I'm trying to raise venture capital of £1 million in the next 9 months. There are a lot more steps that people need to go through between one and the other.
And so when you were talking to people about this, and that they are getting ideas, they're trying to think, okay, well, you're right, I need to get more of a plan. Do you have particular tools that you use? I think kind of maybe the lean model canvas or the business model canvas. Are those good ways for trying to communicate the all of the steps that you need to be thinking about?
Yeah, so I think there are lots of approaches. I generally use the Lean Business Canvas or the Strategizer stuff, strategize.com approaches. I'm not hard and fast about which one you use. You can write it down on the back of a napkin if you want. I don't think it matters necessarily, the method, as long as you actually go through the thought process of, who is going to buy my product? What problem am I solving? How do I think I'll sell it? The questions that those methods all answer are all fundamentally the same. They just articulate the answers in a slightly different way, I feel. Mm. So I'm looking to see whether people have started to, or at least had that thought process, rather than just, I've got an idea.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. So I mean, it's interesting what you're talking about earlier on, because I was intrigued by the fact that you, before Clickworks, you co-founded Adaptive, and that sort of, that was a management buyout, was it?
Yeah, so we worked for National and Provincial Building Society, which was bought by Abbey National. And Abbey National didn't really want, we basically developed some software that was to for change management. And National and Provincial were quite a forward-thinking organisation, and Abbey National were a bank, and the two necessarily don't go together. Abbey National used the software but didn't really see the potential. So a group of us, I think there were four directors, three directors actually, I think, four directors, and a group of about eight, we did a management buyout from Abbey National. We raised venture capital from 3i, as it was then. We raised £1.5 million, which back in 1989 was quite a large amount of money.
Yeah.
And grew that from there, and we scaled that to, so our turnover when I left was about £1.5 million. So that was not recurring because it was installed software. We had about 25 people, and then I left after founder alignment, I think is the politically correct term of we had a big fallout.
Yes, well, I want to come back to that in a moment because I think that's a really interesting
founder alignment dynamic. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
but before we do that, I just wanted to ask: you studied computer information systems at university.
I did.
How did you get to be the marketing director?
That's a good question. I was the product manager. I applied to a job in Ringwood and became product manager for a software company. That was what I always wanted to do, was work for a software company. And when National Provincial bought us, I became the business analyst and product manager. So I was like the interface between the business and the software product that we were building for them. And then I think when we did the management buyout, the company was basically a firm of engineers and me and the CEO, who was his history was procurement. So he became CEO, guy called Dick Powell, and I was the person who was the business guy. So I became sales and marketing director, and that was it. And to be honest, I thought I was like, yeah, I'll do that. It's absolutely fine. I was quite old. I was in, was I 60, 20? I was early, when did we do that? 97. So I was like literally 28. Mm. And I thought, yeah, I could do that. It's easy. So I just did that.
So apart from, you know, fairly quickly being able to learn how to sell 20 hunks of steak from the butcher who's giving you the advice.
Yeah.
How did you learn the rest of the job? How did you try and go, well, what does a sales and marketing director do?
I just sort of did it, I think. You just pick up the ball or kick the ball and run. You just did stuff. I mean, marketing was very different then. I think I was always product guy anyway. So the thing about, so product is a traditional one of the four Ps, you know, in terms of that product marketing was something I'd done in terms of writing collateral and product positioning and product messaging. And pricing was always something I'd done anyway. I've always struggled with the promotional aspects of marketing. I'm not a great promotional marketer, but in terms of product, price, and place, I'm pretty well covered. So for the promotional aspect, it was literally just go and get help. So we recruited a marketing manager who helped a lot. And then from a sales perspective, it was just, and again, one of the things that I talk to founders a lot is that you have to coin a phrase that's quite common at the moment, you have to eat your own dog food. You know, you've got to go and sell your product yourself to start with. And if you can't do that, you're not going to know whether a sales guy is selling your product well. So to start with, it was, I did the selling badly, but you just do it.
So in terms of like you're saying doing the sales badly, but by doing that, you're beginning to learn what it is that people are responding to and therefore how to sell it better?
Yeah, absolutely. I think initially, and I talk with a lot of founders, and it's not necessarily related, but I think a lot of founders think the first thing they have to do is go and get somebody to sell their product. And I think it's almost the exact opposite. I think you, as a founder, if you look at a lot of the great software companies, the first 10, 15, 20, 30 customers, whatever the number is based on what you're selling, the founders generally sell to those guys, you know, that founder-based selling, because you really need to understand why people are buying your, if from a software perspective, why they're buying your product. What is about your product that ignites their passion? Why are they buying it? And it's very difficult to do that secondhand, I think, because then secondly, as a founder, what you're trying to find is not only why people are buying your product, but whether you can build a sort of a repeatable, scalable engine that you can then go to somebody, right, we know this works. We've gone to a 100 people, we've sold it to 80. This is what we did. This is what they liked. This is what they didn't like. So if you get somebody along then to help you with that process, if they suddenly can't do that, you know there's something not quite right somewhere. And what you hope is that when you get a good sales guy, they should be accretive. So they should be adding value and improving the process, not making it worse. Because if you're not a sales guy, you can sell it, then it should be, a good salesman should be able to sell it.
So it's still very much in terms of trying to understand where that product fits within the marketplace more, because I know that you're also kind of interested in the kind of the number side of things in terms of thinking those addressable markets and how you bring those into obtainable markets and thinking a bit more scientifically about it. But ultimately, you've got to get a really clear understanding about why anybody wants to buy it in the first place.
Yeah, I think that's the thing about addressable market is important to think about to start with. But then I do think in the early stages, the focus for founders has to be on how do I get my first 10 paying customers? You can have the big vision stuff, and as long as your addressable market is big enough, you know, your focus is on how do I get my first 10 paying customers? And then from there, it's how do I get to 100 paying customers? And I think you don't have to, obviously, but it helps if you think in those sorts of terms rather than think, well, how do I get to 26 million? Because you can't conquer those steps in one day, whereas getting the next customer is always something that you can do something actionable to improve your chance of success.
So you said you came to Ringwood originally.
Ringwood, yeah.
Okay. So that's just on the outskirts of Bournemouth?
It is.
Okay. And where did you come from and what brought you down there in the first place?
Work. So I was working in London. So I'm from Birmingham originally, moved to London and did some IT consultancy, but I didn't want to stay in the consultancy world. My ambition, and still is to basically work with great software companies. I've always been obsessed by software. And in the early, so in 1993, when I came down to Ringwood, there weren't many software companies in the UK, but Ringwood had a world-renowned software company called, at the time when I joined them, was called VSF. Historically, they were called Systematica, who were based in Bournemouth. So it was a virtual software factory, and they were, I think they would be classed as world leaders in their field in what they did. And they advertised for a product manager, and I applied for the job and they stupidly gave it to me. So I came down to Ringwood.
And so in terms of what motivates someone to move, I suppose it's very much looking about how do you develop your career. That was the real motivation for you.
Yeah, it was just about going to work with software companies. And as I say, there weren't that many in the UK at the time. It was, you know, nowadays, you know, I've had chances to go to the States, and that's probably one thing that whereas in the early 90s, I was from a working class family from Bournemouth. I was the first person in my family to go to university. The thoughts of going to the States were just not even on the radar. It was Ringwood. You know, I got funny looks from my family when I went to London, let alone when I went out of Longbridge and in southwest Birmingham, it was like, what, are you going to London? Why are you doing that? And it was, so the thoughts of going to the States where if it was now, I'd be going to the States.
But despite having left, you've remained a lifelong supporter of Aston Villa, haven't you?
Yeah, no, that's the wrong colours. Yeah, I don't even know who you're talking about.
So not Aston Villa?
I don't even know who they are. Oh.
I was expecting more of a reaction than that, Andrew. I know it's
Birmingham. I'm older now. I'm older. I don't react quite so badly.
I know it's Birmingham City.
My father was an Aston Villa fan.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you're a Birmingham City fan.
I am a Birmingham City fan, yes.
And you're a season ticket holder?
Unfortunately, yes.
Yeah. And so you're travelling from Bournemouth to go up to Birmingham how often?
I don't go to every game now. But yeah, every couple of weeks.
So that's interesting.
When I hear it back, I just realise how stupid that sounds.
Yeah, but I was just interested in that because it kind of shows there's an element of passion and commitment, and that's what football kind of football supporting requires. So I just wondered, do those traits play a part in becoming a successful entrepreneur?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the biggest thing that I find when people ask me what traits do you need? And when I look at people who I've been really fortunate to work with some people who are exceptionally clever, much more clever than I will ever be, and have been amazingly successful. But the one trait that comes through for me from time and time again, it's not the intelligence, it's just complete and utter tenacity to believe that they will get the job done. And it doesn't matter what happens, no matter what befalls them in terms of what highs, what lows, they just keep going. And it's absolutely incredible. And I've got some of that. And, you know, I think the very, very best entrepreneurs just have that. That's what they have.
Yeah. And do you think you can pick up on that immediately? Do you, if you are that person, do you know you're that person? How does that become apparent?
I don't know. That's such a good question. I think there is an inherent self-belief and confidence that you could argue, you know, some people would call complete arrogance of and belief that that's what they have. You know, I think at times you can recognize it. I'm honestly not sure whether you can develop it. You know, there's this big nature nurture debate, and I'm the more I speak to people who are successful, I sort of increasingly come down on the side that it's nature, not nurture. I'm not sure it's something you can learn,
okay,
if that makes sense. Yeah. And that may be a little bit controversial, but so, you know, I'm quite a few of the people, if I'm brutally honest, who've started businesses and want to get to a huge business, I honestly think would be better off just getting a job, because the chance of them actually succeeding are just so small.
And so can you see what it isn't? So that's kind of interesting. In terms of somebody getting a job rather than setting a company, can you see specifically in that journey of trying to deliver a successful company of where they're going to fall down if you're not that sort of person? Or is it not that precise?
I don't think it's that precise. I think it comes down to, firstly, having an expectation of how long it will take you. And then, because I'm quite left-brained and quite linear or focused, it's sort of doing the math to a certain degree, or doing the math, speaking to Americans. You know, I think so when we started, not Adaptive, but when we started ClickTools, we'd gone through the founder alignment problem, and I'd left Adaptive and was fortunate enough to exit with some money. And I was the only person to ever make money from that software company.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. But that enabled, funnily enough, that enabled us to literally, Nick and I, one of the other founders of Click, Nick came to share my house. And we didn't earn any salary for literally 2 years. And that's not an uncommon thing for founders of software companies to do, any company actually, not just software companies. But especially if you're bootstrapping, which 95% of people are bootstrapping, you have to face up to the expectation that you're probably not going to earn any money for a while. So if you've not got the belief that you can get through that period or side hustle so you can make money to live, it's going to be very difficult for you to survive, if that makes sense. So I don't know exactly where people will fail, but I just think there's something that is within people for them to be able to succeed over against all the odds, really.
So because you've been a co-founder a couple of times, and yep. I was just thinking, that is that important that you found something with somebody else?
Yeah. So funnily enough, when I left ClickTools, after twiddling my thumbs for a short while, I literally did try and do another startup as a solo founder. And I absolutely hated it. I think I knew very early on that I wasn't enjoying it. And so should have stopped it quicker than I should, but I've ended up stopping it. But certainly being a solo founder is very different. For the very simple reason that you don't have all the skill sets. You know, I keep coming back to it. I'm quite left brain, quite linear, quite logical, quite analytical. I struggle with my imagination and creativity at times. So in a business, you need that complete brain, if you like. Mm. And I think the only way you get that is by co-founding with somebody else. You can absolutely do the single founder thing. There's no reason why you can't, but you're going to have to find a group of people around you who provide those complementary set of skills.
So did you find that when you were working by yourself that suddenly there's so much more to do, and that when you had co-founders you could divvy that up a little bit and work out who's going to do what? Or
there was certainly some of that. I think it was partly around some of the decisions become harder because they're not decisions that you'd like to necessarily make. So, you know, if there's much on the creativity side, I would sort of struggle because my brain stops very quickly when it comes creative. And
so actually your time becomes less productive because you're trying to force yourself into doing a job that doesn't come naturally. So
yes.
If you were to partner with somebody who's more creative, then that could just be passed on to that person and they can think about that much more quickly.
Yeah, and I think you become a little bit more insecure in your decision-making, I think, so that if you're not certain of something, you know, it's very easy to start to question yourself, question your decisions, and that's sort of almost like startup death. You know, it's any decision is better than no decision. Yep. And I think when you're... what I've certainly found, I'm not saying this applies to everybody, but on my own, I did find it harder to make certain decisions because I didn't have anybody say, right, you go away and you're looking after that. I trust you to make the right decision. I don't care what color it is. Just go and pick a brand or a color or what. That's a very superficial example, but there are certain elements that come into that. Yeah, absolutely.
Do you find you just kind of start thinking more and more deeply about things and there's nobody to kind of snap you out of that and go, come on, let's just get on and do that?
Yeah, although it's probably less and less deeply. It's probably more superficially, just more around the circle at the same time. More superficial, because I don't have the knowledge and the experience to think beyond blue and red. You know, I don't have 800 shades of magenta in my brain to think about the decision. It's just become a bit paralysed.
So coming back to your earlier character assassination of all the people who aren't natural entrepreneurs. No, that's not a thing.
Yeah.
But for people who don't necessarily go, I have that passion and that drive that I really want to come and do that, can you get around that by teaming up with somebody who has? Or do those roles sort themselves out with your co-founders as long as somebody's got that?
No, I don't think so. Again, it's like when I was young, I wanted, the first thing I wanted to be was a footballer. I wanted to be Trevor Francis, played number 8 for Birmingham City.
He was also the first million pound transfer,
yeah, apparently. So, but at some point in time, I was told that I wasn't good enough footballer to be a professional footballer. You know, unfortunately, I that was just the life. The next thing I wanted to be was a singer in a band, not good enough to do that. And I sort of think the same thing applies to entrepreneurship. You know, you can't... not everybody can be anything they want to be. I just think it's a ludicrous proposition.
Okay.
And I think that, so whilst you can complement skills, I think the thing that you cannot replace is passion, commitment, tenacity, those character traits that I sort of see the most successful people, entrepreneurs, I mean, let's successful in that walk, not successful in other ways, but in that light, those are the sort of characteristics they have. Yeah. And I think if you've got a co-founder that's, so when people start a business, I think there are a few things. So the first thing that I say to people is that it will take, once you start your own business, it will take 100% of your time. You will be thinking about it 24 hours a day. So, you know, can I pay the bills? Where am I going to get my next customer from? And it really does consume you. And it's almost like if it doesn't consume you, then maybe that's not, that's not your thing.
Mm. Because I suppose that whole thing, you're going to be successful if you do something which you're naturally good at, because in the way life is going to be easier if you follow things which come to you without you having to force your way through them. So when you come back to the conversations we started out about with some of those kind of early founders, do you ever recognize that people maybe are lacking in that ability, and do you share that information with them, and do they ever take up your advice and go, do you know what? You're absolutely right. Why am I doing this? I'm going to hate trying to do this because it just doesn't naturally fit in with the way that I think.
No, I mean, I really don't. As you know, I can be quite blunt about things, but I don't ever try to stop people trying to realise their ambition. If people really believe that they can do that, I'm not there to stand in their way. I'm just going to try and help them. I would ask them questions about whether it's something they are really committed to, and are they enjoying it. So fundamentally, if you don't enjoy this, there is absolutely no point doing it. So my dad always used to say, he was an accountant, and he bizarrely said, you know, he loved his job. And the thing that I always remember him saying to me was that, listen, just if you find a job, and he didn't invent the phrase, I can't remember who said, but if you find a job you love, you never work a day in your life.
Mm.
And I loved doing the startup thing, but I think it's quite easy to me when people come to me and say their motivation is money. Invariably, those people are not right to do the entrepreneurial startup thing. Okay. There has to be a different.
Better to get a job in finance.
Goal, yeah. The goal has to be something different, yep. And I don't think you can buy that commitment. And that comes back to your founder's point, because if you've got two founders, and one of them is 100% committed and the other one is only 75% committed, I guarantee they will fall out.
Okay. So that sounds like a voice of experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I was kind of interested in terms of when you started with Adaptive and again, when you were gone to ClickTools, did you set up founders agreements? How many founders did you start those companies with?
In ClickTools, there were three of us initially, but then that became four. So that we had a first person join us, a developer, and then he became CTO, but he became a co-founder. Mm-hmm. In Adaptive, there were three or four. I can't quite remember, to be honest. It was a long time ago. But yeah, we had founders agreements. We had shareholders agreements. They were probably quite broad to start with, but then we did fine tune them.
So you can kind of keep iterating them as you go on?
Yeah, you just change them. We literally just iterate them as much as we need to. So that ClickTools is quite an interesting one because when we started, we had a very unequal share allocation. And over time, literally that turned, we equalized it to be, we all had a quarter each, but that probably took us 2-3 years to get to. And that came from two of us or three of us feeling that there was a complete imbalance between the amount of work that we were doing versus the reward we were potentially getting. But we sort of worked that out. You know, we were a very tight team, we were a very functioning team, and that was fine. Because I think in other situations that I've seen that cause tremendous issues and companies fall apart because of those fundamentals.
Do you think it's better to have three rather than two so you don't get that 50-50 split, which can just cause stasis?
Well, so we had stasis with four. Absolutely, in lots of ways. So I think the biggest challenge that we had, and I've experienced this both ways, is that we didn't have, in ClickTools, in certainly some of the areas, we didn't have somebody who was in charge. We were very much a team. We were very flat. And although I think David, I think David was the CEO. Honestly, I don't think we ever let him be a CEO. I think because he could never make a decision on his, he would make a decision, but then we could actively stop that decision. And that definitely caused stasis.
Right.
And I think that became harder the bigger we got. So we probably didn't realize we were very, very fortunate and we did very well, but it's certainly, looking back, it certainly restricted our growth, I think. Whereas initially, we had one person who was very much at the through, I think it was four, who was basically the CEO, but that became a problem the other way, is that, you know, some of the decisions we made, that there wasn't any conversation, and that was ultimately why I left, was down to I just did not agree where the rest of the board were going, and I just thought this is not going to work, and left.
So did you find that the time you'd spent in getting those shareholder agreements up front and founder agreements were useful at the point at which you either want to sell or you want to leave or you want to break up? Did you refer back to them?
Absolutely vital, even before then. Okay. So I think one of the biggest things that I spend time talking about, I've had a couple of conversations about it this week actually, is equity. So there is unfortunately, there's a tendency for people, founders, to give equity around like their sweets. And that's probably the worst thing you can do. Equity for me, and again, the thing is, I can be quite brutally honest, but I don't think I've actually invented anything. All I generally do is look at what really, really successful people and companies do and steal that. I've never done anything original, I don't think.
Left brain.
Yeah, absolutely left brain. So, but if you look at all that a lot of people do, is that equity is for founders, it's for investors, it's for advisors, and it's for employees. It's not for anybody else. It's certainly not for the marketing agency you've outsourced your development of the app to. It's certainly not for a contractor who's working a day a month doing your marketing. You know, it should never be for those people. And then the second thing is that I see people giving equity away from day one. So in software, there's quite an accepted concept, more so in the States, I would say, certainly in the US, of basically called cliffs investing. So you don't get equity from day one. You have to work with the company for 6 months or 12 months before you start to get equity. And then you earn that equity over a period whilst you're with the company. So if you're, say, for example, and I'll make the numbers easy, if you're given 8% of the company, you wouldn't necessarily earn any equity for the first 12 months. And then over the next 2 years, you'd earn 1% per quarter. Or you could even give them the 4% after year one. It depends on how you want to do it. But you don't give that person 8% at day one so that they can then walk away after 6 months and they've got 8% of your business, which is what happens. I see that. I've probably seen that 10 times in the past 12 months where people have ended up with giving people equity that should have no, or they don't even speak to anymore. And they've got, these people have got 30% of their company. And it's fine if, again, it comes back to where you're trying to get to as an individual. If you want to be a, just have a lifestyle business and earn a good salary, then you can absolutely do that. Whereas if you want to go and become a 10 million, 100 million pound company and raise venture capital, that sort of thing will probably kill you over, over a long period of time.
So that's getting into quite a lot of depth in terms of things to look out for. So we probably need to go back to a bit about football again.
Okay. All right.
So I was just thinking, do you know how Birmingham City was founded? Who founded it?
I've probably forgotten.
So it was founded, done my research. It was founded by a cricket team. And basically a cricket team had, they had a field, they got bored over the winter and they thought, let's play football. So they set up...
Small Heath Lions.
Small Heath Lions. So they set up, that was very good.
1875.
It was in fact 1875. Well done. Okay. So anyway, so that I thought that was interesting because that shows two stories. One is obviously cricket is the superior sport. and the other is diversification can be really helpful because, you know, they have their intellectual property and that is their field, essentially. That's the thing that they own and think, oh, we can have more than one product on this. So we can do we can do cricket and we can do football. So I just thought, you know, kind of the experience that you've had in there in terms of understanding IP and trying to diversify it in that way, if you've come across interesting cases.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, funnily enough, I was at an event this week and there are really only five ways of, once you've got a business, sort of growing it. And one of them is, you know, expansion or diversifying into other markets or becoming going international. And yeah, absolutely. I think that's something that I certainly in ClickTools, we didn't exploit that enough. And that was probably down to a lack of business dev knowledge, really. However, what I would say is that I think it's important not to necessarily, there's a point in which that becomes relevant. So I think you've sort of got to have almost got all the low-hanging fruit from your first venture, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So the example, so SurveyMonkey, who I was fortunate enough to do some work with, they really started to grow massively latterly when they went international. So they started to approach different markets and diversified into different markets. But they'd been going probably 12 years before they even did that because there were lots of low-hanging fruit that they could get at a lower cost. So I think if you can diversify at low cost and a low acquisition cost from a customer perspective, then that's absolutely fine. But I do think certain startups try and think about diversification too soon. I mean, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've heard the advice that you're better off just trying to get your product sold in your kind of local environment or your local country at least. But a lot of people start thinking on a global scale very quickly and then they just get stretched too thinly too quickly. So just kind of having that I suppose, more constrained ambition to begin with until you're really consolidated what you're doing.
Yeah, I think until you understand your process, so until it's scalable, repeatable, predictable, I believe that you get most benefit when you almost constrain that to something that's quite nicely defined so you can figure out the scalable, predictable bit. Once you've nailed that, then absolutely you can start to look at other ways of growing it. I think ultimately it would come down to the cost, the amount, how much it costs you to acquire a customer. Yep. It's always cheaper if you're doing it in a smaller area.
So in terms of growth, I mean, quite often that's when people are starting to look for money as well, and you've touched in investment in a few different ways. You kind of started Adaptive with VC money to begin with.
Yeah.
You sold ClickTools. So again, that's kind of like interesting experience. Just wondered if you'd tell us a bit in terms of some of the happy and maybe slightly less happy memories that you've got of getting involved with the whole money question.
Gosh, that's a good one. I certainly found it difficult to start with having venture capital because I thought honestly that the venture capital company would add more value than they did. So they gave us a chunk of money, which was very nice. and presented a different set of challenges in terms of, well, how are we going to spend it? And we did that, and we met some goals. We didn't meet others. But then if we got stuck, the venture capital guys weren't massively helpful, which I think was probably typical of the times. I think it's very different now, but I think you still can get good money and bad money.
Is that because they didn't actually know what they did? They didn't have the ability to help you?
Yeah, probably. I think it was quite a new market, absolutely. But I still think you can get good money and bad money. So, you know, good money has very good networks. They will help you. They'll have lots of other founders in the same sort of space. Bad money, you know, doesn't have experience in the space, won't have a network, and will generally put a high amount of pressure on you to succeed no matter what, which may sacrifice longer term growths.
Are there any ways that you can work out which is good money and which is bad money in advance?
I just think do a bit of research. I think see which companies they've invested in previously, look at the partners in terms of what their record is. So I think in what I do in terms of software as a service, there are some exceptionally well-known seed and pre-seed companies in the UK that you'd always go to first. And if you can't get money out of those guys, then there's probably a second tier who are slightly less well-known. But there are certainly good and bad, yeah, absolutely.
And what about the selling, the experience of selling a company?
That was a bit strange. I think...
It's good. Let me take you back. Sure. So when did you decide that you wanted to sell the company? How soon before you actually started that process? And did you start planning sort of years ahead or months ahead or kind of... How did that work?
Yeah, we didn't plan at all, actually.
Where's that left brain when you need it?
I kept thinking, I was back to it's what's the motivation? I don't think we were doing it for the money. It was our goal was to build a successful software company that probably generated certain revenues, that had a certain number of customers. And as a byproduct of that, we thought if we would do it enough, then we would probably be able to live to a very good standard. Now, whether that was an exit or whether it just became generated by profit, it wasn't, we didn't consciously choose either of those. And I think, funnily enough, I would argue that the fact that we didn't consciously think that means that we didn't take full advantage of when we were acquired. Mm-hmm. So looking back, when we were acquired, we were at the real low point of multiples. They probably got us at a really good stage because as founders, we were all absolutely knackered. Excuse my French. But we were so tired.
Yeah.
I think somebody could have come along and offered us £10 for it and we'd have gone, yeah, right, fine, get it. We've had enough. So we didn't actively plan the acquisition, but we did have, we'd grown really well. We were about 50 people, I think.
Yeah.
We had offices in the US, in the UK. We're serving over 1,000 B2B customers. We were doing well. Consider we bootstrapped it, so from nothing.
Mm. No, you never had investment anytime.
No, we didn't have any investment at all.
Okay.
We literally funded it from going to get a customer, going to get another customer, going to get another customer. We had a loan of about £20,000 from the bank that we all had to sign our houses away on.
Okay.
But it wasn't that. I think it might have been £20,000 each. That was underwriting a loan that we never even, I think we paid it back and it was fine. So it was never at risk. I think it was maybe £80,000 in total, a bank loan. But that was it. There was never any venture capital.
Yeah.
The weird thing was when it actually... So we were a bit strange. We were sort of acquired twice. So we were acquired initially a minority stake by SurveyMonkey. Mm-hmm. And that was a very strange thing because their CEO... We'd had a few people sniffing around. We'd had quite a few conversations with other people that said they wanted to buy us or partner with us. But... we'd had a conversation with a European company, a conversation with a private equity fund, a conversation with a marketing agency, but the conversation never really went anywhere. There was never any alignment. And then we had a phone call from the CEO of SurveyMonkey, a chap called Dave Goldberg, who said, "Oh, I like what you guys are doing. Can we have a chat?" We're like, that sounds a bit strange. They were much bigger than us. And so David Jackson, the co-founder who's the CEO, and I flew over to New York, met Dave Goldberg in their lawyer's offices, I think in New York on the Avenue of Americas. And he sat down and said, "Hi, I'm David." And we had a quick chat and said, "I'd like to buy your company." It was literally that.
Did you get a cup of coffee first?
I think we might have had some water. I think I fell off my chair. And then we just got chatting and he explained why. And so that was quite a high, actually, just to, because Dave Goldberg was very, very well known, and SurveyMonkey were one of the, you know, almost the inventors of software as a service, really. So that was quite a high. But then we had the low that we had a bit of negotiation and talks, and then David came back and said, oh, I can't buy you. My board won't sanction it. Ah. And it's like, oh, what? And I think they'd not been long bought by a private equity firm.
Okay.
So they basically bought some of the company. And that was a bit of a, from a high to a bit of a low. And because it really was strange, because what happened then is we had a bit of a Mexican standoff for 2-3 years.
With SurveyMonkey?
With SurveyMonkey. Okay. In a nice way. We worked really well with them. But there was always the question, it's like, why did they buy this bit of, what was the point? Mm. So we were sort of waiting for them to tell us what they wanted us to do. And I think they were waiting for us to tell them what we were going to do.
Okay.
And I think it was sort of like became this elephant in the room. It was like, what are we doing? So they're really not, I mean, I learned so much from them, going to them and meeting them and the guys there. We learned so much, but it always felt as though we didn't take it. And that's probably completely our fault. We didn't take advantage of that situation. We learned a lot, as I say, but, and then we had another, well, I didn't, but David had another phone call from the CEO of a company called Calidus, who basically said, I'd really like to talk to you guys about what you're doing. And then that turned out into a full acquisition. So they bought our shares and the SurveyMonkey shares and acquired the whole company. So we then became part of Calidus.
So then it got divorced from SurveyMonkey altogether?
Yeah, so SurveyMonkey's Calidus, in effect, bought SurveyMonkey shares.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, so bought the whole business.
Yeah.
And we became part of Calidus Cloud, yeah.
Right. So kind of that whole kind of foray internationally is kind of interesting. It reminds me a little bit of the first time that Birmingham City...
First English team in Europe.
First English team in Europe.
Are you going to talk about Inter Milan?
It wasn't.
Let's say how good your research is.
Inter Milan. I was going to talk about the final. So they got through and they were the first English club to be in the European final.
Absolutely. First team to beat Inter Milan in their own stadium.
Yeah, but that wasn't actually what happened in the final, was it? What happened in the final?
Yeah, we lost.
Yeah, but by how much?
I can't remember the exact score.
I don't know. Five?
Slightly
six,
less than we lost to Bournemouth a few years ago.
Okay. 4-0, I think it was. But I think by Barcelona. I mean, Barcelona. That's like a
I've
top
got
team
the programme at home, actually.
Really? Were you there?
No, I did buy the programme. I've got the programme from the home. It was two legs.
Yes, that's right.
So I've got the programme from the home leg at home.
But they got somewhat annihilated in the new camp. But let's face it, camp, not absolutely. The only people to, for that.
Yeah, it's before I wasn't even born then.
No. What year was it?
50. No, it was the 50s, I think. Yeah, 56.
But it struck me that would be, you know, for an English club to be the first to go into Europe, that would be such an amazing experience. And again, all of this kind of crossed very neatly back into another question of about competition.
Yeah.
And sort of, is the competition something to be new? You would have thought going through that experience, playing lots of other European clubs, you've kind of seen completely different styles coming into play. For some people, they look at competition, go, oh my God, it's competition, and get scared by it. But what about the good side, the kind of what you can learn? Does it kind of should you not be scared by the competition and be inspired by them instead?
Yeah, I think so. It's a good point. I mean, I do think I personally don't spend. I think this is down to each individual. I don't spend too long thinking about the competition. I always remember somebody. I generally do not like quotes, but I think somebody once said, when you're winning a race...
Sorry, hold on. This is your fourth quote.
My fourth quote. Yeah, I don't like them. But somebody, if you're winning a race, you don't look backwards.
Okay.
If that makes sense. Yeah. So I think you should be aware of your competition and understand where you're different. But I think if you have confidence in what you're really, really good at, then as long as you're aware of them, I wouldn't become obsessed by them, which I think some people do. But you've got to be aware of them, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Without a shadow of a doubt. I thought you were going to ask me about going into Europe versus going into the USA then.
No, I think kind of talking anything about going into Europe at the moment is probably not the best time to be doing it.
that's true. Good point. Yeah.
Okay. Well, this is another kind of, we're going to wrap up in a moment, but one more kind of Birmingham City thing. So 1963, what happens? What does Birmingham City achieve in that year?
We might have won the League Cup.
Was that the first league? That was the first trophy ever. And they were founded in, what was it, sort of
1875.
Yeah. So just under 100 years.
Absolutely.
They win a trophy.
Absolutely.
And they beat Aston Villa.
We did.
In the final.
In the final, yeah.
What was interesting was that Aston Villa beat them just a few weeks before 4-0 in the Everyday League.
I didn't know that.
So they'd been soundly beaten by the Villa just beforehand.
I didn't know that.
So I just thought that, again, isn't that interesting about having your head in the right place in terms of the value and the importance? Because presumably that's the only difference really that would have been between the teams at the time.
Yeah, I presume so. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So do you think that's kind of something that you see, kind of coming back to where we started right at the beginning of the conversation, in terms of that thinking of what it is to be an entrepreneur and how to achieve that success? It's a lot of it is to do with what's in your head, or is it actually sitting down and doing the numbers?
I think there's a bit of both. And again, I come to my left brain linear focus. Again, I look at traits of people that generally are, that succeed in what they're doing in, and they generally have a plan. You know, they have a goal. They think, right, this is where I'm going to be in 12 months. And they figure out the steps that they need to take to get there, and they execute on those steps. They may succeed or fail. You know, it's not the succeeding or failing that's the important bit. It's actually setting the steps and the goal and realizing that you have a goal. And that's certainly one of the things that I try to encourage everybody that I work with to have, is basically, right, where are we going to be? Where do you guys want to be in 12 months? Is it, if you're at £10,000, maybe it's at £11,000. I don't really mind what it is, but go through that process of setting yourself a goal and then fixating on that goal. So that comes down to a bit of both. You've got to understand your numbers so you can figure out where you are at that particular point and where you are on your journey. But then also it gives you the focus to figure out, well, how do I need to get there? If I need to go and get another 20 customers at 2 a month, how am I going to get my 2 customers from this month? And if I haven't got them, it's now the 15th of November, I need 2 new customers in the next week. And it's that level of, certainly in the early days, that's the drive. It's literally down to doing those simple things to meet those simple goals.
Yeah, that's probably a really good place to stop, actually, just in terms of thinking, okay, do we know where are we going to get the next 2 customers from in the next month, or the next 20 customers, or the next 200, depending on whatever that number is.
Yeah.
And if you haven't thought about that today, perhaps you should.
Start, absolutely.
Andrew, thank you so much. It's been brilliant to talk to you.
Thank you, Anthony.
I hope you enjoyed the episode. There's more information about all of our guests and all the topics they talk about at 10thdegree.co.uk. And also, please do review us. We really want to share the lessons and the advice that's given as widely as possible, and this really helps us to get that message out there. Thanks.